Welcoming in our friend, the talented writer, Colin Fleming. Hello there, Colin.
Hey, what's up, Kimball?
Much to talk about on this Tuesday afternoon. And as always, a smorgasbord of interesting topics. Shall we begin with your wonderful short story that you sent me, Gunsmoke, or a little film noir?
I always like to put myself in your charge and follow your lead. So you do your thing, big man.
All right, well let's go see Doc and Festus and Miss Kitty at Gunsmoke, which was for a long time the longest running drama in the history of television, now out on DVD.
What beats this longest running drama?
Law and Order finally passed it.
Oh, that's still on?
Apparently, yes. That was my reaction, too.
Okay. Yes, Gunsmoke. Well, the reason we're talking about it is because there is a mega box set, as you can imagine, with something that runs for 20 years, of the complete whole shebang that just recently came out. And this is a time, too, when seasons weren't like 17 episodes. I mean, they must have been working constantly. All shows were like that. It wasn't just the Gunsmoke thing. But there were so many episodes in the season, and there are 600-odd episodes of Gunsmoke. It comes to some just insane number. And there are all of these different iterations of the show. Like, Dylan has his various phases. Well, there are phases of Gunsmoke, and I'm always interested in, like, what phase a given person likes best, because everybody seems to have favorite. And I will say that, like, the color episodes from near the end, or it's actually color episodes for kind of a while, I don't think they've held up nearly as well as the black and white ones. And some of the reason is the way they look. Orson Welles had remarked that when you photograph a face in color, it often looks like baloney. And I think that's especially true sometimes of a TV series that had been around for a while. If it didn't have, like, that kind of pop to it, that color pop that you get with, like, Time Tunnel, right? That, like, late 1960s type series. Where Gunsmoke, they're like, okay, let's just kind of leave this out there. It's been around for a while, let it do its thing. And it looks kind of washed out and ruddy, but it was so crisp before then. The almost film noir-esque photography and Matt Dillon getting shot, like, in every other episode. And I was thinking, not like I imagine Matt Dillon, like, nude a lot, but can you imagine what his body must have looked like? He must have been, like, Frankenstein together. And I think,
isn't that why Miss Kitty just, you know, would never really push the relationship, because the man was falling apart.
That was the official rule, that they would get hitched and she would lose him. And you'd think after a while she'd be like, look, the bionic man, he's going to be fine. Okay, so maybe he's not as fast on the draw as he used to be, but he's like late career Wayne Gretzky or Michael Jordan. He thinks the game better than the other gunslinger, and sure, Chuck Connors and the Rifleman could take him out, but we don't have to worry about the Rifleman in these parts. It'll be fine. And it was fine. In fact, I don't know if this is on the box set, probably not, but they came back in all of these made-for-TV movies, like, into the 90s, like the early 90s. So It was a show that just really didn't ever kind of go anywhere. And people love it, I think, because it's one of those shows, like Leave It to Beaver and Eddie Haskell there just passed, but it's one of those shows that you encounter in reruns. It debuted in the mid-50s, so it's like a fifth of a century before, like, my earliest days, but I knew it because it was just always, it was a constant, like Andy Griffith's show, Brady Bunch, as much as the shows that were on, that were actually current during that time period when I was growing up. So it's always been there.
Now, it's not exactly the Marianne versus Ginger question, but for me, I always preferred, for the sidekicks, I always preferred the Chester episodes with Dennis Weaver to the Festus Hagen episodes.
Chester's really good. I think you can't go wrong with either of them. The thing that I like about Festus is he is the smartest on the show. He doesn't speak in this kind of smooth patois, certainly. And he has his very folksy kind of, who was the manager the Red Sox had there?
Maybe, Joe Morgan.
Who am I thinking about?
Morgan?
Not Brady Little, the guy, Jimmy Williams. He's like the Jimmy Williams type. He has these expressions that he uses, but he's always like much more perspicacious than everyone else on the show. He just kind of talks like an idiot, whereas Chester was this sort of Marshall Dillon shadow and this gopher, this go-between who was highly principled. But I kind of like the rawness of Festus. But any of those episodes with those two, or one of those, each of them on those episodes, that to me is kind of like the glory run. It was an extended glory run, but when you see one of those come on, Mr. Dillon, like, it's really going to be just great entertainment. And it doesn't, it's going to not pull a single punch at the end. You come to the end of some of these episodes, and it's like, really? You're going to leave it like this? That's bleak, man. And it's almost like Gunsmoke was saying to you, yeah, we're stuck on that. Life gets a little bleak. See you next week, boyo. And I like that about the show.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Over the weekend, I tuned in and let you know that one of the films that we both love in the film noir realm, The Great Out of the Past, was on with Kirk Douglas and a brilliant performance by Robert Mitchum. And we wanted to talk a little bit about the fact that, well, it was not a universally acclaimed great film.
No, and James Agee, who's a writer I really admire, and anyone who's heard me talk about writing knows that I don't give out the compliments that easily. It's not like I'm some Scrooge with them, but I think very few people ever have been good at writing, and I think hardly anyone is now, but even back during James Agee's heyday of the 1940s and 1950s, when he wrote in all sorts of different manners, it was almost like a smaller version in a way of what I do. He did film criticism, he did fiction, he did poetry, and he tried his hand at screenplays, and he was drunk an awful lot. And he was this movie reviewer. I think the best writing he did artistically was his film criticism. And he is one of the people that we have to thank. Probably really two people we have to thank. One of them is Buster Keaton, the other is James Agee, for why Buster Keaton had this kind of renaissance where he was finally elevated above Charlie Chaplin, who I don't think is really within the same district as Buster Keaton as an artist. I think he's fine, but Buster Keaton was like a Shakespeare of silent cinema. And Agee wrote this essay about the silent clowns, and he was writing about Out of the Past, and he said, he had a great line in his review of Out of the Past. He said that Robert Mitchum, like, he plays this idiot, Jeff Daly. He essentially calls him a moron. And he says he's super saturated on barbiturates. And he's kind of like sleazy with the ladies. Which is just, like, awesome. Now, a lot of people, and he calls Jane Greer, he said in an older idiom, she was what was known as a hot number, which is pretty true.
Oh, yes.
But what I like about this is that people now, they get so upset when someone talks about something they like so much negatively. It's like a personal attack. Out of the Past is my second favorite film, probably, and James Agee is one of my, I don't know, 10 or 12, 15 favorite writers, and I liked it. I think he's completely wrong about this film, and he's wrong about it in such an evocative, interesting way. I mean, I know the biography, and this guy was just, I mean, he died at 45, almost 65 years ago to the day, like this week. He was just an amazing alcoholic in terms of, like, how inebriated he always was. And so he probably was looking at it like, pie-eyed here, I'll watch this film, and then I'll let my crows carry the day. I'm never going to see this film again. So I don't think he really vetted it that hard, but there it is. Not exactly a rave of a review.
Hey, you were telling me, too, that a new Mitchum Western Noir is new out on a DVD, Rachel and the Stranger. I don't think I've ever seen that.
It's one of those. So Mitchum, this is the late 40s, and there's another film in this kind of subgenre called Blood on the Moon, which is also the name of, I think, a Cagney film. It's completely unrelated. And Mitchum was the noir guy, and he was also kind of the Western guy. And someone decided to pull a Reese's Peanut Butter Cup and jam those genres together. It's pretty interesting. So you have this Western noir, and you think about the West, and we do think about wide open spaces. Think about wide open spaces, not a lot of tree coverage or certainly buildings. You think sunlight. And that's really kind of the enemy of noir, but they found a way to make these Westerns that had this noir element. And Mitchum was the quarterback of these particular enterprises. And Rachel and Stranger is one of the best ones. And it's like, if you're really into Mitchum and you're just really into kind of finding nuggets that people aren't aware of, that just kind of has been passed by, it's one of those classic films for that. And I'm sure it's out there online free if people don't want to get the Blu-ray from Warner Brothers Home Archive. But it's one of the, when I got into Mitchum, I was like checking out all his early films from like a kind of golden period. And that was one of the first ones I saw. It was the video store on VHS. And it was just like, you knew it was an amazing video store because they had that. And it's like, where else could you find something like that on VHS?
Well, I kicked myself for missing it somehow, but I'll take care of that pretty shortly here. We're talking with Colin Fleming, and I want to talk about this wonderful new short story that you sent me called A Problem to be Solved. Science fiction that relates pretty directly to the world we're in right now, but also shows us a path out of it.
Yes, I don't think that there's really anything like it, because as you said, it is science fiction, but it's also social realism, and it's a kind of social commentary. And what the story does is it imagines the potential fallout, and we're somewhere off in the future, so 100 years from now, 200 years from now, we don't know exactly, we just know that people live a lot longer. The potential fallout of things that were happening in the world and what looks like it's our time. So it's after our time, but we know that 40% of the population was wiped out by a virus. And there's no naming of a virus. And that was able to go on because at the same time, there was this maybe thornier problem. The people were literally being absorbed into their computers. And people couldn't figure out a way to stop staring at their screen, even with this health risk and advances in science had discovered that not only did we actually have a soul, but you could measure the soul. So some of these people who wouldn't be able to give up their time looking at the screen agreed to have their souls hooked up to these machines. So when they disappear through their computers, hopefully we'll be able to trace them. But we're never able to. People lose people, and the government is just sending checks all the time because there were all of these lawsuits, and everyone's house gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and you have wings. And you have like a track upstairs on your fifth floor, and no one has any friends, and people have no way of interacting. And their lives are prolonged. And it doesn't become like the solution, time heals all. What people start to realize is maybe it doesn't do that in any fashion whatsoever. Maybe you're left with your grief for longer periods of time and no resolution for it. And this man who is in this situation, is visited by some kind of presence, a kind of energy parasite in reverse from another world. And he thinks maybe it's his wife who disappeared into the computer. Maybe it's her come back again. Maybe it's her energy come back again. And it's this being of another world who reaches out to other worlds where people have become worlds unto themselves. And she is able to help him as other people are simultaneously being helped in their giant houses. And the world gets back on a kind of track in a way that I think is very surprising. Simple, but not a way that anyone would see coming as they read the story.
And the story also looks at different views of life and death, and that it might not be the same for everybody.
No, it might not be. I think it's one of those stories where everything is in the story. It is linear, and it is clear. It's not necessarily chronological, which is different. And as long as it's in there, that's what I'm interested in. That doesn't mean that when you're in front of the class that John doesn't raise his hand and have one idea about what's happening, who this alien presence is, and that Sarah in the next row over doesn't have a completely different idea that differs from John. But I think that's what you want, right? That's really kind of, as long as you're not doing it as a con, as long as you, the author, know, the creator, and as long as it's actually in there and you're not just trying to hoodwink people with like that kind of, oh, it's so vague, it must be deep. As long as it's clear, it can still be open to interpretation. And I think those are the works that really fire discussion that never go anywhere, that we are always talking about, so long as it's not a cheat. And the story is not a cheat.
No, it is not. A very powerful problem to be solved. Hey, I wanted to ask you, and we haven't talked about this, but I know I can throw anything at you and you'll be ready for it. Did you watch any of the Michael Jordan documentary? And if so, what were your reactions to it?
Well, this being me, not only did I watch it, I wrote a lengthy feature on it looking at the cinematic techniques. How's that for you? As though I was Godard. No one has written about this, has written about actually how it works in cinema. They just say the same thing. Jordan was the GOAT. He's better than LeBron. LeBron would get hurt. He'd tap out. Yeah. Yes, I did watch it. And I finished it yesterday. And from just a sports standpoint, the thing that bothers me about it is that Reinsdorf gets off so easily when he could have stopped the whole Jerry Krause thing all along. And we lived in Chicago, or I lived in Chicago for a good portion of all this was going on. And just the idea that you can earn the right to lose in this life. And I think that's a great thing. I think losing is a great, awesome thing when someone comes along who's better, who takes it from you. I think that speaks to what a winner you are, that you got your chance to lose. And it bothers me, and they might have lost the next year. They were running on fumes. It bothers me that they didn't get that chance to lose, because I think within the context of that era, in terms of degree of difficulty, like them or hate them, the Patriots, with their 20-year run, it's the most impressive, unlikely thing in the history of North American sports. But in terms of the best team that had the strongest competition and what those Bulls did in the NBA of the 90s, I think that's just blows the Canadians away, the Celtics certainly, the Edmonton Oilers, the Islanders. That's just the most impressive, dominant run I've ever seen in any of the North American sports, and I wish they could have lost. Strange thing to say, but I wish I could have seen them lose.
Look forward to reading your piece. We'll talk more about it, I'm sure, and I may have some thoughts on Jordan that I'll run by you that we'll chat about at some future get-together here on the radio.
Are we going to wager?
We might. I like that. I raises the stakes a little bit. Sure, we'll talk about that as well.
All right. I'll see you, buddy.
Thanks, Colin. Colin Fleming. Check out his work, colinflemminglit.com.